Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of a recent episode exploring the history of investors holding businesses accountable and the dawn of the ESG, or Environmental Social Governance, movement.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Imagine a not-so-distant future where you're just driving on the highway, but your car is sending real-time data about your performance behind the wheel to your insurance company. And in return, the insurance company is sending real-time driver behavior modification punishments back, like real-time rate hikes, curfews, even engine lockdowns. Or if you behave in the way the insurance company likes, you get an instant discount rate. In other words, the insurance company is shaping your behavior right then and there. Would you like that? What does it mean for our entire understanding of free will? Well, that future may not be far off. It started with Google sucking up your data to serve you targeted ads, then Facebook selling of that data to groups who want to influence your votes, and now Harvard big thinker Shoshana Zuboff says where it goes next could threaten democratic governments and even individual autonomy. This hour on Point, the rise of surveillance capitalism. And you can join us. Do you care if companies are tracking your every move, your choice, your online interactions? Do you buy the notion that it could threaten your free will in the future? Or does that just strike you as technophobic alarmism? What, if anything, should be done to protect all of that personal data we're throwing out there? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And joining us now from New York is Shoshana Zuboff. She's professor emerita at Harvard Business School and a former faculty associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. She's author of the new book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Shoshana Zuboff, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Meghna. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a great pleasure to have you, and we have a lot to discuss here. I was wondering if you could just start by giving us, in the sort of most graspable terms, what you mean when you talk about surveillance capitalism. What is it?
Surveillance capitalism is an unprecedented approach to making money, for lack of a better word, capital accumulation. And here's how it works. It unilaterally claims private human experience as its own commodity that can be translated into behavioral data, which can be then sold and purchased in a new kind of marketplace that trades exclusively in predictions of our future behavior, what we will do now, soon, and later. So what you immediately see in this remarkable new equation is that we've shifted the whole premise of exchange and how capitalism works from a relationship with customers to a relationship with people that is one of simply raw materials. Mm. We are no longer the customers of capitalism. We are its free source of raw materials from which predictions of our behavior are fashioned for trade in these new, in a certain respect, ominous new futures markets that I call behavioral futures markets.
Okay. So if I may, I mean, is there a good example of this that people may recognize at the moment? Because I suppose, you know, the one I threw out earlier, one of them that I threw out earlier about targeted ads, for example, I mean, a lot of people might say, what's the harm?
Okay. Well, let's work our way toward what's the harm.
Okay.
The thing about these examples, Meghna, is that they literally are all around us. it's easy to, you know, I write in the book about surveillance capitalism being discovered, invented, elaborated at Google, migrating to Facebook, becoming the default option for Silicon Valley startups, apps, and so forth. But now it's everywhere. It's across every economic sector. Let me give you a couple of examples. And I think it's useful to put this in context. So surveillance capitalism was being invented in between 2000 and 2002, and it was being applied at Google. We can go back to that later if you choose, but here's something quite interesting. 2002, a comprehensive review of telemedicine written in that year before anyone knew about surveillance capitalism because Google kept it quite a secret. So here's this comprehensive review, and there are data scientists and engineers involved in this review. And the review includes a diagram for a proposed digital architecture of telemedicine. And that diagram is a simple closed loop. It includes three nodes. One is the patient in her home. One is her physician, and the other is the hospital where the server is located. Mm. And so the whole idea here is that a person's health data, all the information about their body, what they're doing, how they're feeling, that is the essential elemental property of the person. My body, my information. And it's mine to decide how it's used, what it means, all of that. And I can use that to enhance my relationship with my doctor. That's as far as it goes. That's 2002, before we had heard of surveillance capitalism. Now let's fast forward. And I want to take us to the year 2016, where there are now more than 100,000, quote, mobile health apps. So let's drill down in just one version of this. And this comes from nothing less than the Journal of American Medicine, which I think a lot of our listeners will recognize as an authoritative source. So here's a comprehensive study of Android-based diabetes apps. Right? We still want telemedicine. We still want all of those advantages for us. But here's what they found about diabetes apps. They examined 211 apps, and then some of them, about 70 of them, they selected for deep dive analysis. Anyway, what they found was that just by downloading the software for the app, it automatically authorized the collection and even the modification of sensitive personal information on your phone.
Wow.
And then they figured out that 64% of those apps secretly modify or delete your information. 31% secretly read your phone status and identity. 27% secretly gather location data.
And this is without ever even opening the app, just downloading it?
Downloading it.
Wow, okay.
Backstage operations. Another 12% take advantage to view your Wi-Fi connection, so they can get a lot of information from that. And then there's actually 11% that go ahead and activate your camera so that it can access your photos and your videos. Finally, they found that between 4 and 6% went even further. They read your contact lists. They called phone numbers on your phone. They modified your contacts. They read your call logs. Some of them even activated your microphone to record your speech.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so Professor Zuboff, though, let me ask you, what is the reasoning that these app makers are giving for needing all of this information just by downloading their apps? Certainly, they must have... You can hear that my tongue-in-cheek here, but certainly they must have good reasons. Is it supposed to make the app perform better? Is it supposed to make you healthier? I mean, we're talking about telemedicine apps. What are they saying?
You're right, Meghna. They have very good reasons. Those good reasons are the economic imperatives of surveillance capitalism. And the operations that I'm describing to you are exemplary. These are excellent, highly skilled operations in surveillance capitalism. As far as helping us, that's really not in the equation when it comes to these backstage operations that are intentionally designed to evade, bypass our awareness. So in a way, we're living in this bubble that is constructed to keep us ignorant of the very things that I write about in this book and that the American Journal of Medicine was so kind as to bring to our attention with this brilliant research.
Ah. Well, so, I mean, you write in the book about how the end, I don't even want to say the end game, but one of the goals here of surveillance capitalism, as you call it, is more than just commerce. It's more than just shaping our behavior to buy stuff. I mean, you quote people as saying the goal of everything they do is to change people's actual behavior at scale. I mean, is this one of the reasons why you have this very searing criticism of these new technologies as being a threat to free our very notions of free will?
Indeed. So can I tell you a little bit about the imperatives of surveillance capitalism?
Because yeah, just so you know, we have about a minute before the first break, but go ahead and then I'll let you pick it up when we come back from a break. But go ahead.
All right. That sounds great. Just to say that, you know, surveillance capitalism, like other forms of capitalism, is a competitive operation and there are competitive dynamics. And the key competition is around, you know, who's going to get the most predictive behavioral data? What is the most predictive behavioral data? So this started out as, you know, we need scale. We need volumes. We need to just extract as much as possible. And as the competition heated up, then it became clear that we also need scope. We need a lot of data, but we also need varied data and, you know, different qualities from different levels of the person and different aspects of their action.
Hmm. Well,
should I pick it up when we come back?
So Shoshana Zuboff, stand by for a second because we definitely want to hear more when we come back. Shoshana Zuboff is professor emerita at Harvard Business School and author of the new book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. We'll be back with a lot more. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're speaking this hour with Professor Shoshana Zuboff. She's professor emerita at Harvard Business School and author of the terrific new book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. It's just out today, by the way. And Professor Zuboff, I want to come back to hearing you tell us more about what you call the imperatives of surveillance capitalism. But I also just want to play a little bit of tape here to get the voice of, you know, those people making decisions in the tech world. Because, for example, in 2010, then Google CEO Eric Schmidt talked a little bit about how the company approaches searches. And he said this.
We don't need you to type at all, because we know where you are, with your permission. We know where you've been, with your permission. We can more or less guess what you're thinking about. Now, is that over the line? Is that right over the line?
We should take a vote.
Is that right over the line?
It's getting
okay,
pretty close.
Okay, so maybe our guesses won't be very good. Maybe we'll limit those. You see what I'm saying? So we'll try to find that line to try to help you understand more about the world around you.
That's then Google CEO Eric Schmidt in 2010. And Shoshana Zuboff, you hear him there repeatedly saying, with your permission, we're trying to find that line. But then it's also the part where he says, we're just trying to help you understand more about the world around you. I mean, how does that comport with what you were telling us about, what you see as the imperatives, as you're saying, of what surveillance capitalism actually is?
Well, okay, there are a thousand answers to that question, but let's start with this. First of all, let's be clear. We approached the internet and the wonders of the digital world seeking empowerment, seeking the democratization of knowledge, seeking a whole range of freedom from the frustrations imposed upon us by real-world institutions. And there is no question in my mind that digital technologies offer us these tremendous gifts, these great, great riches. The argument I make is that 21st century citizens should not pay for those privileges with the situation that we're in now, which is having been relegated to the status of free raw material for a new regime of capitalism that is oriented toward business customers, that takes us from being subjects, as we were in the original vision of telemedicine, to being objects, as we are in today's vision. So the first thing is, how do we rescue that those capabilities of the digital that allow us to know one another, that allow us to know about the world, that allow us to democratize knowledge and information? How do we rescue that for a different kind of future where we are not paying the price in the forms of these massive asymmetries of knowledge and therefore power that the surveillance capitalists have amassed at our expense and at the expense of democracy?
So are you I'm sorry to jump in here, but are you foreseeing a kind of new totalitarianism?
Well, you know, you ask a good question there, Meghna, because I think the easiest thing in the world is for us to look at all of this and say, oh, man, you know, Big Brother is back and digital totalitarianism and so forth. And, you know, I've always celebrated the folks who are using their critical thinking to have these perceptions. But I think there's a real difference between what's happening to us now and what the ghastly horrors that we saw mid-20th century in the form of totalitarianism. So totalitarianism, as many of our listeners know, was a murderous ideology. And it worked through violence and terror and quite literally, as we know, murder in order to control and subdue populations. And it wanted to dominate people from the inside out. Stalin's famous phrase, the engineering of the soul. What we're seeing now is a new kind of power. This power works through the medium of this massive digital architecture that increasingly surrounds us. And it does not want to harm us. It doesn't want to hurt our bodies or, you know, cause us to bleed. It doesn't want to deal with our sweat and our pain. It doesn't want to torture us or kill us. But it is very happy to extract the data that leeches from the pain that we may be experiencing, just as it is equally happy to extract the data that leeches from our joy and happiness.
Professor Zuboff, though, may I just jump in here for a second? Because you said something that's really provoked a question in me. Because, I read your book and your copious writings about this as saying that, like, in the future, the end game is, you know, collecting all this data real time, the flow of all the information we're putting out there just in the course of living our daily lives, our realities, essentially. And then using that data, selling that data, shaping that data to in turn, you know, whether it's the particular company that collects it or a third party to modify our behaviors in turn. I mean, if that's indeed the future that you see, what is that other than a new kind of engineering of the soul?
All right. Well, the first thing to know is that, as we were talking about the imperatives before, scale, we need a lot of data. Scope, we need various sources of data. Eventually, surveillance capitalists in this competitive dynamic understood that the most predictive data comes from actually intervening in people's behavior. Because if you can intervene in their behavior and you can gently shape their behavior one way or another toward the commercial outcomes that you seek, well, that's the most predictive of all. The most predictive of all is data that comes closer and closer to approximating observation. So there's not much guesswork involved. So there have been massive scaled experiments in this implementation of a global means of behavioral modification, which is what we're getting at here. The idea that, and, you know, for example, something as simple and innocent, apparently innocent, as the game Pokemon Go that enthralled people all over the world in the summer of 2016. Well, it turns out that Pokemon Go was running its own behavioral futures markets. So there were restaurants and pizza shops and, auto service centers and bars and so forth that were paying to play in these new futures markets. So they would have Pokemon creatures in their establishment, or they would become a certified gym for the Pokemon activity. And then the game itself would help, you know, give you incentives and herd you and nudge you and tune you up so that you would finally end up in these specific establishments which had paid Niantic Labs, originally part of Google that invented Pokemon Go. Paid them, you know, for the privilege of getting your body in the door. This is actually a kind of prototype of what you're signaling to our listeners, that the idea here is the more that we can actually shape people's behavior toward the commercial outcomes that we seek, the more lucrative our predictions, the more money we can make in these futures markets, the happier our business customers are. Yeah. So there is a collusion now between the business customers, who, by the way, began in the world of targeted online ads, but we've moved way beyond that. The idea of targeted online ads is like, you know, that's like saying that mass production was only relevant if you're making Model Ts,
right,
because that's where it started, right? That's where it began. But now, you know, we're talking about business customers in the insurance industry, in the automobile industry, in the finance industry, in the entertainment industry. All kinds of futures markets being established in all these different niches and sectors. So this is becoming the new road to profit margins.
Okay, so let me.
And what we're seeing.
Oh, I'm so sorry to interrupt, but I.
Sorry.
But,
no, not
but
at all.
To be perfectly honest, everything that you're saying is giving me this dark feeling in the pit of my stomach about our present and our very near futures. But let me just offer some pushback here, because I suppose, you know, there is a line of thinking that would say. I'm thinking of your Pokemon Go example. And I guess I asked this question a little earlier, but I'll do it again. Is it a problem if there's not really any harm being done? Or are you saying that you see the potential for harm in how the uses of these technologies could undermine liberal democracy? I'm just trying to say, like, you know, like the genie's out of the bag. These technologies are being developed. And right now, many of us, whether we want to or not, kind of are maybe okay with what's happening. So what is the fundamental harm being done here?
Well, you know, you introduced our conversation with the idea of free will. And I understand that for a lot of people listening to this, you know, that may sound like a big stretch. But when you understand the principles of behavior modification, you understand it's all built on stimulus response. The idea is that I can, you know, create a set of conditions that actually will reliably produce certain kinds of behavior. This kind of thing was practiced, you know, with pigeons and rats and so forth. But now and it's also very interesting to know that in the 1970s, you know, there was a significant Senate committee chaired by the great Sam Irwin, you know, of Watergate fame. Mm-hmm. Some listeners may recall his name in the Watergate scandals, because he was quite a dignified senator who stood up to that situation. And it reviewed the use of behavioral modification in any kind of program with federal funding. And this Senate committee came down so hard on behavioral modification as an affront to the values of a democratic society, as an affront to human autonomy, as an affront to the kind of free citizen that is essential for a functioning, robust democratic society. And it withdrew federal funding from any kind of institution, mental hospitals, prisons, even schools that were using behavioral modification on its, you know, inmates, patients, and so on. Now, again, we fast forward to our time. And it's not just Pokemon Go. Some will remember 2012 and 2013, Facebook proudly published in top academic journals the results of what it called its massive scale contagion experiments.
Right.
Whereby subtly manipulating bits of content in your newsfeed and so forth, in the 2012 experiment, it tried to see if it could get people to vote in the 2012 midterm elections. And it proudly announced that indeed its subtle manipulations, which it specifically described as evading the user's awareness, did increase people's voting behavior. Again, a year later, even while the whole world was up in arms about the first experiment, a year later, it published the results of a second experiment where they used subtle cues, subliminal cues in the newsfeed and other features of the Facebook page to make people either feel happier or sadder.
Right.
And again, announced proudly that they were successful. So what we're seeing here is the sort of slow drip, you know, the old fable of the frogs in boiling water. We're seeing the slow drip so that we become habituated first to these sort of innocuous, perhaps, versions of behavioral modification. But this is now a program that is being conducted at scale across every domain of society. I mentioned the Model T before. The Ford Motor Company, the CEO of the Ford Motor Company, the crucible of mass production and the, you know, the product is the essence of the of capitalist exchange. The CEO of Ford Motor Company recently announced that in a response to the sustained slump of global car sales, the next big thing for Ford Motor is going to be to monetize driver data.
Mm-hmm.
So that 100 million people are driving, he says, in Ford cars. And just think of all the data that we can get from those cars. And then we combine it with all the data about you that we already have from Ford Credit. And you put that all together and we basically know everything about you. And he says, how's that for monetizing data? And a top analyst in the auto industry says, you know, this is a great future for Ford. They don't have to build factories. They don't have to employ workers. It's all pure profit. Because what that's like the full circle coming round to this situation where we are the objects,
right,
not the subjects.
Is this why you call it a parasitic form of capitalism?
I do indeed. It is parasitic because it's about us, but it's not for us. It's about us, but for the purposes of serving others' financial goals and others' financial gain. And by the way, it's important to know that this is a sharp divergence from the history of market capitalism and certainly from the history of market democracy. You know, capitalism and democracy have found a kind of equilibrium over the past century in the fact that there are these organic reciprocities, that capitalism needs people as its customers and it needs people as its employees. Surveillance capitalism needs us for nothing except, again, as I said, as the free source of raw material.
Well, Professor Shoshana Zuboff, stand by here for just a second because we do have to take another break. But when we come back, I want to hear more about your view of whether or not regulation is part of the solution here. So stand by. We are talking with Shoshana Zuboff. Her new book is The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. A lot of callers have been waiting patiently, and we'll let them in as well. But we'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're speaking this hour with Shoshana Zuboff. She's professor emerita at Harvard Business School and author of the new book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. And I just want to play a little bit of tape here from a couple of well-known CEOs from the tech world again, just to get sort of how they see the rise of surveillance capitalism. You heard a little earlier from Eric Schmidt, former Google CEO. Here's another moment from 2010 where Google's chief economist, Hal Varian, suggested that in the future, rather than conducting searches on phones, people would just be able to do searches via an implant in their brains. And a few days later, journalist James Bennett spoke to then Google CEO Eric Schmidt and followed up on that idea.
Is this a realistic prospect in 10 years? And do you understand why it kind of creeps people out a little bit?
There's what I call the creepy line, and the Google policy about a lot of these things is to get right up to the creepy line but not cross it. I would argue that implanting things in your brain is beyond the creepy line.
Mine in particular.
Yes, at least for the moment, until the technology gets better.
That's former Google CEO Eric Schmidt talking about towing right up to the creepy line. Well, another different view can come from, for example, Apple, because it's tried to position itself as a tech company that cares about user data. Here's Apple CEO Tim Cook at a conference on European privacy or before European privacy commissioners in October.
We shouldn't sugarcoat the consequences. This is surveillance. And these stockpiles of personal data serve only to enrich the companies that collect them. This should make us very uncomfortable. It should unsettle us. We at Apple are in full support of a comprehensive federal privacy law in the United States.
That's Apple CEO Tim Cook, and in a couple of minutes we'll talk about whether or not we're capable of forming the regulatory tools to deal with what Shoshana Zuboff calls surveillance capitalism. But let's go to the phones. Dave is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Dave, you're on the air. What's your question for today?
Hi. Thank you, Professor. It's amazing what you're bringing to light. I'm going to buy your book today, and I wanted to ask for your comments on the continued and ongoing censorship of people like Jordan Peterson, Ben Shapiro, Dave Rubin, Camille Paglia, and those who have opinions that differ from the narrative, and how that plays into the control that you believe or that you that we may see these corporations or entities trying to exude over the American public. And thank you very much.
Professor Zuboff,
well,
go ahead. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Dave. Now, were you talking about censorship in the online environment?
I think that's what he was referring to, and the allegation that companies like Facebook and Twitter sort of de-emphasize those voices in the news feeds of millions, if not billions, of people.
Yes. Well, look, the whole news feed as an institution is deeply problematic. And the idea that that there is a private company, this is a corporation. It's not your friendly community service. It is a corporation, and it's a surveillance capitalist corporation. And the idea that we have given essentially Mark Zuckerberg, because he owns control of a great majority of voting shares, and he has been able to develop his company in an environment nearly free of law and regulation that would prohibit him from doing whatever he wants. And so we have essentially given this one young man control over the way in which information flows in the connected social network. This is pretty bizarre when you think about it. And the news feed, early on, they made a choice that they were going to treat everything in the news feed, make it look exactly equal, so that you could have a newspaper there, like there's something called the Denver Journal, I believe it was called, that was a completely fake paper. It didn't exist. And something from that would come through the news feed right after something from NPR or something from the New York Times. So they supplanted journalism, and they did it in a way that that responded to their interest in engaging users for as long as possible in ways that would encourage those users to produce as much data as possible. So their metrics for this feed were surveillance capitalist metrics, were their own revenue metrics, not the metrics of what's good for us. What are the different flows of information that are correct for a democratic society? How do we make sure that there's no fake information in these flows, because that undermines the ability of citizens in a democratic society to share a reality? So this censorship problem, Dave, I would say, is part of this larger, extraordinary development of the concentration of power in a company for no reason other than it got there first and it got there unobstructed, and we haven't done anything yet to stop it. Mm.
Well, let's go to Brian, who's calling from Melrose, Massachusetts. Brian, you're on the air.
All right, thanks for taking my call. So it seems like we've had a scaling up of information long before this period that's being called surveillance capitalism. But I want to push back a bit on the free will portion of the discussion and just ask, if we have free will, then what's the worry about the collection of the data?
Huh. Okay, Brian, interesting question. Thank you for your call. Professor Zuboff, what do you think?
Yes. So, free will, you know, this is a very fraught subject, certainly, you know, in philosophy and so forth. But let me just kind of, you know, simplify a couple of points here. One is that the idea of free will is that, all right, there's the present moment. And in the present moment, I can imagine a future moment. For example, I spent a really long time writing this book, Brian. Actually, 7 years. I joke about it. 7 years in my pajamas writing this book, long book. And so I imagined a future where this book existed. On any single day, I could have gotten up and walked out of my house, walked out of my study, you know, and sort of gotten back into the stream of life. I chose not to do that, because I was choosing the future. I wanted to create the future that only I could see, only I could envision. And when philosophers talk about free will, this is an essential part of it. The idea that we can close the gap between the present moment and what we envision for a future that only we can see. We do that through our commitment to certain courses of action that we will. We literally will action. Now, the thing about this surveillance capitalism using the vast architecture of the digital surround to create this new means of behavioral modification that touches us in all kinds of ways, almost always out of our awareness. What that does is that really intervenes between the present and the future, because that puts its own reinforcers, its own incentives, its own subliminal cues and ways of shaping and hurting us in between my sense of the present and my idea of how I want to project myself into the future. Mm-hmm. That's the idea of stimulus response, that human agency that should come between present and future is displaced by a form of stimulus response. We know that this works. We know it's very effective. Professor B.F. Skinner, who was one of my teachers at Harvard a million years ago, you know, prove this beyond a shadow of a doubt, and many behaviorist scientists since then. So the thing is that when this is happening massively, ubiquitously, using technologies that we must engage with if we want to participate in our lives and in our societies on a daily basis.
That's right.
It's happening out of our awareness. We have no choice, really, because when it's out of our awareness, we are robbed of self-determination. And those decision rights that, you know, really give me a chance to consider what's actually going on here and what is the cost-benefit. Mm. So going back to that creepy line, what Eric Schmidt is talking about is the creepy line that you see, because they blew by the creepy line a long time ago. They just do it backstage, so we don't know about it. That's what concerns me, Brian.
Well, Professor Zuboff, we got about 5 minutes left here, and I cannot let this conversation go on any further without asking you, what should the regulatory response to surveillance capitalism be? Because, I mean, you write about how surveillance capitalism thrives, is dependent upon a certain lawlessness, right, being beyond the reach of regulation. But on the other hand, I think, you know, you talked about the power that Mark Zuckerberg has a few minutes ago. I think he recognizes that perhaps in the future that there is regulation on the horizon. So I just want to play a quick bit of tape for you, because in April, when he was before a joint session of the Senate Judiciary and Commerce Committee, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham asked Zuckerberg about why the government should let Facebook regulate itself. And here's what Mark Zuckerberg said.
Well, Senator, my position is not that there should be no regulation. Okay. I think the internet is increasingly important.
You embrace regulation?
I think the real question, as the internet becomes more important in people's lives, is what is the right regulation, not whether there should be or not.
But you as a company welcome regulation?
I think if it's the right regulation, then yes.
If it's the right regulation. But Professor Zuboff, you write in your book about how our conventional conceptions of privacy protections, it's an inadequate framework to deal with surveillance capitalism. So what is the new framework, regulatory framework, we ought to be thinking about in dealing with this?
Well, believe me, you know, privacy is critical, and we have privacy law. We need more. The antitrust issues are critical. We have antitrust laws, and they need to be enforced. But neither of those specifically addresses this unprecedented logic of surveillance capitalism. So my argument has been that, you know, it's like, you can't design a vaccine unless you have a deep and accurate understanding of the enemy disease. And that's the history of every successful vaccine, is how do you actually understand the disease? Then the vaccine gets a lot easier. So in this situation, we need to understand how surveillance capitalism works, which is why I've spent, you know, chunk of my life trying to figure it out and share it with people. Because, for example, let's say we just broke up Facebook, but didn't drill down into the level of some of these foundational operations that I've been describing. If we break up Facebook, that means maybe we have four smaller surveillance capitalists instead of one big surveillance capitalist. Right. And then we also disrupt the competitive landscape, opening up opportunities for more surveillance capitalists to come in and compete for the behavioral data and the revenues from the futures markets. So obviously that's not enough. We need to understand exactly how it works, how it unilaterally claims our experience, how it takes our experience, how it translates it into data, how it claims the right to translate our data into predictions, how it claims the right to sell those predictions to other people and not to us, how it claims the right to do all of this without our knowledge, and how it claims the right to maintain the conditions that allows it to have all these other rights. Yeah. So that's what Mark is saying. Oh, yeah, regulation, cool. Let's make sure it's the kind of regulation that lets us keep doing what we're doing. Thank you very much.
Said every powerful CEO ever, right?
But said every powerful CEO ever. Going back to the Gilded Age, those guys used to say, we don't need law. We have the law of supply and demand.
We just have a minute and a half left here to go. And I'm very, I mean, the language that you use about these corporations, these surveillance capitalists claiming rights for their own is very stunning. That could be another hour conversation for us. But I must ask you one last question, Professor Zuboff.
Of course.
Where do you draw the line personally in your own life? What technology apps do you use, do you not use? I mean, how do you go about living in this world of surveillance capitalism?
Well, we're in a situation now where basically every device is a supply chain interface for behavioral data. Everything that has the word smart in front of it or personalized is a supply chain interface for behavioral data. So I try to limit my exposure to those interfaces. I don't need them. I've never been on Facebook. I have lots of friends and family, people that I love. I like to see them. I like to hug them. I like to touch them. I like to go visit them. I like them to come visit me. I have a phone and I have an iPhone. I have no apps on my iPhone. You know what? I lived a long time without apps. I don't find any difficulty at all in living a bit longer without apps. You know, I understand why people need them. People need them because we are harried, we are frustrated, we are stressed, we are pressured. Everybody's working. Nobody has time. So we turn to these apps for succor and support. But indeed, the price we pay, as we've been discussing, is just too darn high. I'm not willing to pay it.
Well, Shoshana Zuboff is professor emerita at Harvard Business School. Her new book is The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Professor Zuboff, this has been an incredible, remarkable conversation. Thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Meghna. I just love talking with you. You're fantastic. Thank you.
And listeners, thank you for joining us as well. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.